From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, we'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak. Ceasefire or not with Boko Haram in Nigeria. Turkey allowing Iraqi Kurds to join the Kobani fight, plus atheist churches on the rise. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Meeting in Havana, Cuba on Monday, a group of Latin American and Caribbean countries pledged to aid each other in the event of an Ebola outbreak. Cuba and its closest allies in the region also said they were seeking ways to aid West Africa, which has been at the center of the Ebola outbreak that has killed more than 4,500 people since March. Cuban President Raul Castro said his country is willing to work shoulder to shoulder with all countries, including the U.S. He said, according to the Cuban health system and its modest experience, coordinated willpower is needed. Here in Washington on Monday, the spokesperson for Secretary of State John Kerry stopped just short of welcoming Mr. Castro's comments about working with the U.S. Here's Marie Harf.
This is a global issue that countries need to step up and help confront in any way they can. And the Secretary very publicly and openly said that we thought this is a significant contribution by the Cubans.
Cuba has already made significant contributions to stemming the epidemic in Africa. They've sent 165 doctors and nurses to Sierra Leone and another 296 set to depart for Liberia and Guinea this week. Latin American officials who met in Havana on Monday called the global response to Ebola insufficient and vowed to reinforce detection and prevention training and education for public health workers. So far, there have been no cases of Ebola reported in Latin America or the Caribbean. Authorities in Guinea are accusing taxi and motorcycle drivers of causing the spike in the number of Ebola cases there. Karim Kamara traveled for VOA to the town of Koya, one of the cities hardest hit by the virus, and has more on the situation.
Guinean authorities are blaming the spike in new cases in part on drivers from Koya who go through the border town of Forikaria and bring in sick people from neighboring Sierra Leone. The government says taxi and motorcycle owners are also providing transport for sick people waiting to escape detection by medical personnel out of fear of dying in treatment centers. That is simply not true, says the head of the drivers union in Koya. Ibrahim Asuma tells VOA that the drivers have been at the forefront in the fight against Ebola from the beginning of the outbreak. He says not one of the drivers have ever been caught transporting an Ebola patient. In fact, they will refuse any passenger who refuses to wash with detergent before getting into their vehicles.
Aujourd'hui encore, on a eau de javel partout à la gare routière, même les passants.
He says today again we have disinfecting detergent placed all over the transit park, and even passers-by must wash hands properly prior to entering the park before they can get a ride or go to the cafe bar here. More suspicion has fallen on motorcycle drivers because it is easier for them to cross the border. But Abubakar Sila, head of the Motorcycle Drivers Union, says that is unfair.
He says
we take proper passenger to their destination. He says we can transport someone to the hospital, but not to take them across the borders. He says his drivers use precautions and asks their passengers to use precautions, including washing with detergent and disinfectant to stop this deadly disease in Guinea. More than 800 people have died of Ebola in Guinea since the outbreak began last year. There are more than 1,000 confirmed cases now, with three new towns reporting their first cases. These towns include Sigirin, Farana, and Dalaba. Koya has about 37 confirmed cases, with 20 deaths recorded. Villages around Koya have been reluctant to cooperate with efforts to raise awareness about the virus and its spread, mostly due to fear and suspicion of medical authorities and foreigners. Karim Kamara for VOA News, Koya.
Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, distributed thousands of home medical kits on Monday in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, which has been particularly hard hit by the Ebola outbreak. Marcelo Mazzotta is an MSF distribution manager in Monrovia.
We know that it's not easy to do a fair distribution, you know, when you just drop the kids or the buckets to the community leaders or chairmen for them to then take responsibility to distribute them in the community. So that's why we prefer to do it ourselves in order to reach really everybody.
In Liberia, where Ebola patients have been turned away from overflowing clinics, the kits have everything one needs to look after ill family members. And as the families care for the sick, potentially exposing themselves to Ebola, humanitarian teams on the ground hope that the spread of the disease will be slowed by the materials they distribute. Sheldon Yett is a country representative for the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF.
These kits are designed to do just that, to break the cycle of transmission. They're not designed to be a substitute for hospital care. They're not designed to be a substitute for any kind of care that can be provided in a professional health clinic or medical establishment. They're there, designed to ensure that a family member can provide basic assistance in the interim period before somebody can go to an Ebola treatment unit.
In Sierra Leone on Monday, a third UN staff member died of the virus. The man, identified as a driver for members of the UN Women's Agency, died over the weekend, his spouse currently receiving treatment. Meanwhile, the mayor of Freetown pleaded with merchants, bikers, security officers, and Ministry of Health officials to keep the capital's citizens off the streets, to reduce crowds, especially in markets, to improve Ebola prevention efforts. World Health Organization says the city remains a hotbed of transmission. The WHO also says Nigeria is free of Ebola after 42 days passed with no new reported cases. WHO representative Rui Gama spoke Monday in Lagos.
This is a spectacular success story that shows to the world that Ebola can be contained. But we must be clear that we only won a battle. The war will only end when West Africa is also declared free of Ebola.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan issued a statement on Monday praising Nigerians who worked hard to contain the disease. He also directed that all anti-Ebola measures in Nigeria remain in effect, including health screenings for people entering the country. Nigeria had 20 cases of Ebola and 8 deaths as part of the worst ever outbreak of that disease. In Luxembourg on Monday, EU officials committed to provide nearly $1.3 billion in Ebola assistance to West Africa and agreed to appoint an Ebola coordinator to bring together resources and funding, but they rejected halting direct flights from the region. And in the southwestern U.S. city of Dallas, Texas, officials announced Monday that the 21-day quarantine has been lifted on 23 people who had contact with the state's first Ebola patient. But the Dallas mayor said 120 others who had contact with one or the other Ebola patients are still being watched for signs of the virus. Also in the news, new clashes between soldiers and Boko Haram militants are reported in northeastern Nigeria. These and other deadly clashes in Borno State over the weekend have cast doubt on the ceasefire that was announced by Nigerian officials last Friday. An aide to President Goodluck Jonathan has said the sides are set to hold talks later today in Chad about the release of more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by the militants in April. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf was asked Monday about the ceasefire and the schoolgirls.
We would welcome that ceasefire, call on all parties both to implement and maintain such a ceasefire, and hope that such a ceasefire would herald the return of peace to the northeast. This is a region that has had far too little of that. It's our understanding that the negotiations about a deal to release the girls continue. Obviously, would join the world, I think, in hoping that these girls would be reunited with their families as soon as possible.
Boko Haram has terrorized Nigeria for the last 5 years as it tries to turn the north of that country into a conservative Islamic state.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Turkey has announced that it will be allowing Iraqi Kurdish fighters to use Turkish territory to support the besieged Syrian Kurdish city of Kobani. The announcement is a policy reversal and comes after U.S. forces airdrop military supplies into Kobani, which is under assault by the Islamic State militants. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
At a press conference in Ankara, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu announced Turkey will allow Iraqi Kurdish fighters, known as Peshmergas, to cross Turkey's border with Syria to support Syrian Kurds defending the city of Kobani.
Biz de Peşmerge güçlerinin destek için Kobani'ye geçiş için
We are helping the Peshmergas cross into Kobani, he said. Our discussions are still underway. With Kobani besieged on three sides by Islamic State forces, the Turkish frontier is the only possible ground entry for resupplying the border city. Cavusoglu refused to give any further details on the numbers of fighters and weapons that will be allowed to cross the border. In Kobani, Syrian Kurds, known as the PYD, are calling for heavy weapons, in particular anti-tank missiles, to counter Islamic State tanks. Ankara has been hesitant in allowing Peshmergas into Kobani to help the PYD. That's because Turkey accuses the PYD of being linked to the PKK, a rebel group that's fought the Turkish state for three decades for greater Kurdish rights. On Saturday, the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, reiterated that position. At the moment, the PYD is equal with the PKK for us. It's also a terrorist organization, he said. Ankara's policy reversal follows the US dropping military and medical supplies into Kobani early Monday. Observers say those supplies, along with intensifying airstrikes on jihadists by US-led coalition forces, increases the likelihood that Kobani will resist Islamic State forces. Soli Özel, international relations expert of Istanbul's Kadir Has University, says Ankara may be looking to the Iraqi Kurdish fighters to mitigate the influence of the PKK in Kobani.
They obviously trusted the Iraqi Kurds more because the Iraqi Kurds are more conservative, and the Iraqi Kurds were Turkish government's partners in fighting the PKK as well because they are afraid of the PKK as well.
But analysts claim that while divisions remain between the rival Kurdish political factions across the region, the onslaught of the Islamic State has brought them closer together. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
And also Monday in Iraq, Islamic State militants unleashed new bomb attacks that killed at least 33 people. That happened at a Baghdad mosque and in the holy city of Karbala. U.S. and Iran are both helping fight Sunni militants in the Islamic State group, but one of the biggest battlefields is Syria, where Washington and Tehran back opposing sides in that country's civil war. VOA's Scott Stearns reports on how that's affecting the fight.
The United States and Iran are both backing Kurdish fighters in Iraq who've retaken some ground near the Syrian border with help from coalition airstrikes against Islamic State fighters who are also known as Daesh. Meeting with Arab allies, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said there's broad support for the fight.
Every country in the region is opposed to Daesh, without exception. And whether it's Iran or Lebanon or Syria itself or Turkey or Iraq, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, they're all opposed.
But in Syria itself, it's less clear whom best to back against the Islamic State.
Iran faces a very different, a very difficult calculation about exactly what its interests are, just as the United States does.
Georgetown University professor Nora Ben-Sahal says Washington and Tehran are both sorting through a broad mix of on-the-ground forces.
The problem is that in Syria, everything is so interconnected that it's not as simple as the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The enemy of my enemy might still be my enemy on a whole lot of other things.
The Obama administration is determined to keep its contacts with Tehran focused on rolling back its nuclear program. But there have been direct talks on Syria and the Islamic State. Iranian National Security Council Director Ali Shamkhani says Tehran stands steadfast against more direct foreign intervention.
There will not be an intention of a ground intervention because they failed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we oppose any foreign intervention in the region by these states.
Tehran will not allow the fight against the Islamic State to weaken Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, says American University Professor Akbar Ahmed.
Iran has a very aggressive foreign policy. It's not going to just allow events to take place without having a say in them or attempting a say in them.
U.S. officials say one area of agreement with Iran is the fight for Kobani, where there are no Syrian government forces, and both Washington and Tehran support the Kurdish opposition. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Jordan is among the Arab countries that have joined the international coalition against the Islamic State militants. VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi speaks with Besma Momani. She is an associate professor of international relations at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. He asked her if Jordan would put boots on the ground in the fight against the militants.
I doubt that. There is no domestic appetite. I think particularly if it is to fight this elusive ISIL force, which I think many Jordanians still don't have a good grasping of. They don't see the threat being near, even though the Jordanian government has been very careful in demonstrating and explaining this threat to the broader region. Jordanians, I think, are more introverted when it comes to using their domestic forces. They haven't engaged in any recent history with any military adventure, and I think that's the consensus throughout the country. There is a great deal of more local concerns with the economy and with prices and, again, closer to home types of issues that the Jordanian people would want the government to focus on and not to really invest money or blood into fighting ISIL.
How about Jordanian role in cutting funds, curtail recruiting, and providing a moderate Islamic alternative to ISIL's hateful ideology?
Well, that's obviously the objective of every country in the region is to be able to provide a suitable narrative against ISIL. But I think also ISIL really thrives on the reality of having two governments in Damascus and Baghdad that have done everything to basically exclude much of the Sunni population. So I think to counter that, one needs to think about both the Jordanians and others how to create inclusive governments themselves. And that really is not an excuse to avoid democratization, but in fact to pursue it, because the more reforms and democratization within these countries, the more likely prospects of many of the local population feeling that they have a stake in their government. And that's the best way to really thwart ISIL's advance in any of these countries.
Final question. The Muslim Islamic Front and also the lower house of the Jordanian parliament are warning against any Jordanian role in the campaign against ISIL. Would such internal opposition halt Jordanian participation in the effort?
I think many of these agencies and institutions really reflect a broader feeling in the country that they don't want Jordanian troops to be involved. They don't want Jordan to be actively focusing on these external issues, that they want them to focus on domestic issues. I think that's a sentiment that's widely held throughout the country. Of course, Jordan has to balance the domestic sentiment of wanting to focus at home with the real external reality of needing an international coalition to counter ISIS. I think that can be done with further explanation by the Jordanian government of what exactly its involvement is in this effort, being transparent, and obviously continuing with democratization efforts that really promote an inclusive government at home. And again, that's the best way to thwart criticism against the government that somehow it is taking advantage of the external instability to basically repress and consolidate power against democratization internally.
Besma Momani, Associate Professor of International Relations. She's at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, and spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go.
Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Atheists, by definition, don't believe in God, and so they don't need church, do they? But 2 years ago, a pair of British stand-up comedians decided to create one. Sanderson Jones and Pippa Evans told the BBC they envisioned something like a church, but without God. Their Sunday Assembly movement has grown from a single congregation in London to dozens of churches around the world. Reporter Mike Osborne visited with the members of a Sunday Assembly that now meets regularly in the U.S. city of Nashville, Tennessee.
Sunday morning, time for the monthly atheist assembly in a downtown Nashville park.
Stand out with me, guys!
The gathering really does look and feel very much like church. There are songs, all Beatles tunes, on this day.
The comfort and care on which we depend is given.
Special readings, a message, even an offering at the end of the service. Original Nashville Assembly member Landry Butler says church provides a great model for building a sense of community.
That has a powerful way of bringing people together for the common good and of focusing that energy. And so we wanted to use that as a model because it's something that people are familiar with.
Church is especially familiar in this region. Religious participation rates in Tennessee are some of the highest in the nation. So Butler says he's always surprised at how many believers show up for the assembly.
They go back to their regular church the other Sundays of the month, and then they come and hang with us when they can. And that's been a good way of sort of bridging those two communities.
That gap between believers and atheists has always been tense and sometimes hostile. Butler says the assembly isn't interested in conflict.
There are a lot of atheists out there who like to beat up on religious people, and we're not about that. We want to be all-inclusive.
A good example of that inclusiveness plays out regularly at a local homeless shelter. Volunteers from the Sunday Assembly routinely help serve meals at Room in the Inn, a Christian ministry that serves Nashville's homeless. The group prepares food, serves it, and interacts with the men and women who show up for a hot meal. Elvis Wilson says one of the Sunday Assembly's core values is help often.
As an atheist, you know, I want everybody to know that I care, and I, you know, we have moral values. We want to live in the now. We want to make sure people in this lifetime are treated with respect and well taken care of.
The Sunday Assembly movement has experienced phenomenal growth. At the end of September, more than 30 new assemblies met on a single Sunday. The founders, British comedian Sanderson Jones and Pippa Evans, are now in the process of crowdfunding a website that they hope will tie the global movement together. For VOA News, I'm Mike Osborne in Nashville, Tennessee.
Apple's new iPhone models drove record sales of more than 39 million phones in the last quarter. All told, Apple sold $23.7 billion worth of iPhones, beating the $21.5 billion in sales expected by analysts who were polled by FactSet. Apple Signature smartphones are the company's biggest source of revenue and profit. Apple's profit rose more than 12% for the 3 months that ended on September the 27th to $8.47 billion. Cupertino, California company issued a strong forecast for the upcoming holiday season as well. Well, baseball's 110th World Series, sometimes referred to as the Fall Classic here in the U.S., begins tonight with the American League champion Kansas City Royals hosting the National League champion San Francisco Giants. It's a best-of-seven game series with the first two games in Kansas City before the teams travel west to San Francisco for games 3 and 4 and, if necessary, 5. If a game 6 or 7 is needed, they would be back in Kansas City. Royals get the home field advantage because the American League won this year's All-Star game against the National League. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today here on The Voice of America. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On October 21st, 1512, German monk Martin Luther joined the theological faculty at the University of Wittenberg. In 1517, Luther nailed a list of controversial ideas known as the 95 Theses to a chapel door, setting off the Protestant Reformation. In 1797, the Navy frigate USS Constitution, known as Old Ironsides, was launched in Boston Harbor. On this day in 1805, British Admiral Horatio Nelson died in the Battle of Trafalgar. Nelson was one of the world's greatest naval strategists and tacticians. He led Britain to many victories at sea, especially during the Napoleonic Wars. In 1895, the government of Formosa collapsed when Japanese forces invaded. 5 decades of Japanese rule over the island known as Taiwan followed. On this day in 1917, American jazz musician John Berks Gillespie, better known as Dizzy, was born in Chera, South Carolina. Dizzy Gillespie was one of the founders of a style known as bebop. He also pioneered the fusion of Afro-Cuban rhythms with jazz music. In 1941, Germany announced that its soldiers had killed thousands of Yugoslavian civilians in retaliation for the killing in another city of 10 German soldiers and the wounding of 26. The massacre at Kragujevac came after the fall of Yugoslavia to the Nazis during World War II. Hundreds of Yugoslav schoolboys were among the dead. On this day in 1967, during the Vietnam War era, thousands of left-wing demonstrators, black nationalists, hippies, and other disaffected groups marched on the Pentagon in Washington. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Ebola epidemic may have begun in West Africa, but its scope is increasingly international. The 2014 epidemic first appeared last winter in southern Guinea and quickly spread into Liberia, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, and Senegal. So far, Ebola, which has a mortality rate of 70%, has killed about 4,500 people in West Africa. But diseases do not respect national borders, and in recent weeks, Senegal, Nigeria, Germany, Spain, and the United States have reported confirmed cases of the viral infection. Most, but not all, of the victims contracted the disease in West Africa. Clearly, Ebola is a global threat, and the best way to rid the world of this disease is to deal with the epidemic at its source in West Africa. But that requires money, equipment, medical and technical expertise. The United States is sending help. To date, the United States has contributed $258 million and allocated up to another billion in support of as many as 4,000 U.S. military personnel that include many already on the ground in West Africa. The U.S. is also building 17 Ebola treatment units, providing mobile laboratories and communications infrastructure. We are using every instrument of American power in order to get this job done, said Secretary of State John Kerry. But we know that no matter what we do, we're not going to be able to do it alone.
And we've been raising this issue in every single bilateral meeting that I have. But we know that nothing that 1, 2, 3 countries do together is going to solve it. We have to all be engaged in this. There is no country that is exempt from being able to do something to be able to contribute to this effort and help make a difference. And everything we do depends on how we coordinate our efforts as partners and how we contribute together.
If we don't adequately address this current outbreak now, said Secretary Kerry, then Ebola has the potential to become a scourge like HIV or polio that we will end up fighting, all of us, for decades. Ebola is a threat to every person, every country. The United States calls on the international community to join us in this fight.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.